Welcome to Pomegranate Health. This is an appendix to episode 29 on drug interactions and polypharmacy, and contains excerpts not included in the published story. The interview features Professor Rick Day of St Vincent's Hospital and the University of New South Wales, and Professor Sarah Hilmer of Royal North Shore Hospital and the University of Sydney.
Now, it's sort of interesting, just today before coming via my registrar, an elderly patient, I think, was 68, I think. Young, really.
Young patient.
Middle-aged
patient.
Middle-aged patient. Atrial fibrillation and had a carcinoma of the lung, which was removed. Risk of thrombosis on two fronts. So the drug selected is rivaroxaban, one of the new oral anticoagulants inhibiting factor 10, which we don't monitor. We just give the drug to. Now, the patient's GFR was said to be about 60. That's the kidney function, which is important. So that's reasonable. The patient's quite light, and not, you know, 50 kilos. So the starting dose was 15. And the question was, well, our target's 20, but we're also starting the person on itraconazole because they've got aspergillosis in the lung. What do you think the dose is? This is the question to us. So in our discussion, my sense is we're inhibiting the metabolism of rivaroxaban. We've got an older person who's not very heavy, who has atrial fibrillation, who we don't want to have a stroke. I mean, I was feeling nervous. I said, let's stick with 15 and then try to figure out whether or not that's enough anticoagulation or not. But this is a good example. In this drug, which has got a, I guess, a therapeutic index, which is pretty narrow. Too little, stroke. Too much, bleed to death. And
were you tempted to say just use warfarin so we can monitor it?
I hadn't thought of that, but it's a very good suggestion. That's a good one. We'll take that back. Yeah.
It's common enough. So some immunosuppressants need to be used very carefully. For example, the enzyme that detoxifies azathioprine is inhibited by allopurinol used to treat gout. So what are the outcomes of this interaction?
Yeah. So this is really considered to be one of the most important drug interactions not to miss, because if it is missed, the azathioprine, being an immunosuppressant and cytotoxic drug, can have catastrophic effects by knocking out the bone marrow. Allopurinol blocks one of the elimination pathways for azathioprine, so the concentrations can become excessive. So the advice is they're contraindicated. But the other advice is, well, you can use them together if you reduce the dose of allopurinol very substantially. So, in fact, gastroenterologists have found that actually using the combination is helpful for inflammatory bowel disease. We are able now to measure the concentrations of this metabolite that's active and potentially toxic, the thioguanines, so that you can actually get the doses right. But this is not for general use, really.
The last important interaction should be mentioned, the non-steroidal immunosuppressant methotrexate. What are the concerns you have about prescribing this?
So, look, it's really heavily used. And, look, it's extremely safe if the dose is right and it's monitored properly. However, I guess I've seen a couple that have been catastrophic, where people have been on methotrexate legitimately for something like rheumatoid arthritis, not an excessive dose, renally impaired or on the edge of renal impairment, all going well, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole started. Now, each of those drugs actually interfere with folate metabolism. The elements of the bone marrow are suppressed. So there have been cases, and they've ended up in courts, where people have been sued for negligence because of using the combination. But it's usually not just the antibiotic, it's usually renal impairment. Now, it's also difficult because on interaction alerting systems, it'll often pop up that it's a cause of a drug interaction, and they're not unless you're giving huge doses of methotrexate. And this illustrates that flagging a potential drug interaction seems like a very obvious thing to do, but what we know is that doctors quickly turn off reacting because they see so many of them. And so how do you select the ones to put into an alerting system so it'll make sense to an individual doctor?
And clinicians are sort of obviously follow the guidelines as best they can. Sarah, in your review in Medicine Today, you say that clinicians are often more knowledgeable about the effectiveness of medications and how to start prescribing them than about how to identify the harms and when to stop them. Why do you think that is?
Look, I think it reflects partly our training, partly the way that our postgraduate training is done and the way that drugs are promoted, partly the way drugs are regulated, whereby there's nothing specifically in the product information on when to stop a drug or how to stop a drug. And I think it's also partly because we're physicians and we like to help, and we like to think we can do something with a drug that can help. That's the main dimension we have as a physician.
Is there sometimes resistance from patients themselves?
That's for asking. Yeah, look, the other factor really is the patient side of the equation. Whenever we ask patients, would you be happy to stop a drug if your doctor said that you could, over 90% of patients in any setting will say, yes, I would be happy if my doctor said I could. A lot of patients don't like the idea of sort of I rattle when I walk and would like to be on less medicines, but they trust us as their doctors and they presume that they're on all their medicines for a good reason and they need to be on them. So I think it's really up to us to talk to our patients about it. I've been involved in a few studies, and it looks like, depending on your setting and your intervention, you can usually stop an average of about 2 drugs per patient, and survival is the same. So you don't have to worry you get to kill people.
Is that a real fear that clinicians have?
Absolutely. Well, we're prescribing these drugs because we want to help, and particularly the preventative drugs. We are concerned that if we stop them that something bad might happen, and a real barrier is the medico-legal concern that you stop, say, a cardiovascular preventative drug and then someone has a stroke or heart attack and you're in court trying to explain why you stopped it. There is growing data that you can use to support your actions, the first being a lack of efficacy of a number of these drugs in the very old. The second piece of evidence you can use is the fact that if a person's having side effects, those side effects may well be worse for their overall function and their quality of life than any potential benefit of preventing an event. And yeah, the third and growing body of evidence is the evidence around the safety of deprescribing. And when people have done this in a randomised controlled trial way, survival is no worse. Vascular events are common in older people, but they will happen whether you're on the drugs or not. The only other thing I wanted to squeeze in, probably in the evidence section, there is increasing evidence about deprescribing, which can help practitioners feel comfortable about what to do and how to do it. There's increasing evidence about deprescribing particular drug classes and that it's relatively safe, doesn't increase mortality, and how to monitor it, and generally the patient-level feedback is very good. So I think the evidence is probably best around stopping psychotropics in people who have behavioural and psychological symptoms of dementia. And there is very good evidence that you can stop these. And in even a placebo-controlled, randomised trial, rigorous trials, people actually wind up doing better in terms of survival and also doing slightly better in terms of their neuropsychological symptoms. You don't have to worry that when you stop them, people are suddenly going to have terrible behaviours. Behavioural symptoms of dementia fluctuate over time. Because there's such a strong evidence base of safety and efficacy in that setting, there are actually quite a lot of implementation studies. And one was just completed recently by...
And Sarah, can you explain why ageing biology might increase the concerns about rhabdomyolysis and interactions?
As I explained earlier, in old age, your body is essentially smaller and your hepatic clearance and your renal clearance, but for statins it's predominantly hepatic, is impaired. So if you give the same dose of a statin, then you will essentially have about twice the concentration floating around in your bloodstream. Partly it's also pharmacodynamic. As you get older, you have less muscle. Therefore, what little muscle you have, you don't want to damage. Certainly rhabdomyolysis is a concern, but even just aches and pains and a little bit of proximal myopathy without a raise of CPK it can be enough to just put an older person off their feet and impair their function to a stage where they lose their independence. And it's really a matter of increased susceptibility, whereby a relatively small toxic effect can have a big functional impact.
Clinical trials obviously exclude older people precisely because of the many confounding factors. Is there any way to feasibly consider all those comorbidities and drug interactions during clinical testing?
Well, I think that there's all sorts of developments about how we gather data, which might be described as more real-world data, and make sense of it, and even translate that into evidence and guidelines and even regulatory interventions. We've got a long way to go. People are wary about trials that are not pristine. So you need to deal with that, and it's challenging. Now, increasingly, we think we can. Big data, we're talking about it a lot, about a lot of the data that we use to feed the big data is administrative, and it's not collected in a way that we would in trial. So these things to deal with. However, there are interactions and being observed using these systems, and even spontaneous reports. So, for example, there are some huge databases at FDA, also WHO. You can use statistical techniques to identify outliers. That is another way to deal with this conundrum of the real world.
One of the challenges with some of the adverse effects we see in older people is they're very hard to recognise specifically as adverse effects, because as we get older, people present with non-specific presentations that could be due to a number of things. So if someone presents with a fall or with confusion, it could be partly an adverse drug reaction. It could just be that they're getting older. It could be an environmental factor. It could be a disease. Chances are it's a combination of all of those things. And so recognising and reporting those as adverse drug reactions is quite difficult.
And should we be holding our breath for this famous electronic health record that would collate all of those prescriptions?
I think we should. I think it's really an important thing. It's technically absolutely doable. And, you know, the current exercise, my health record, is starting to bite. And the idea of having a better understand list of what a particular patient's on to all people concerned, practitioners, is such a fundamental need. And it's really a big hope for the future.